On Tech News Today, Volvo's using Microsoft's HoloLens to sell you a car. Plus, LG canceled its cell phone smartwatch after only 6 days on the market. And IBM's Watson supercomputer is already making your holiday shopping list, checking it twice. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, November 20th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by BowlandBranch.com, the most comfortable sheets on the planet. If you order right now, they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets, plus free shipping. Just go to BOLLANDBRANCH.com and use the offer code TNT. And by Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping in time for the holidays when you go to ring.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin. Our co-anchor today is Mashable senior tech correspondent Christina Warren and her rose gold headphones. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you. We're very happy to be here.
It's pink. Let's be honest. It's pink.
They're pink and they're fantastic. I mean, it's hard to tell kind of the lighting that I've got in this booth that I'm in, but it's the exact same color as the iPhone 6S or 6S Plus if you get it in rose gold, and that means it's beautiful. It's awesome.
Got to have style. That's all I'm saying. Now, speaking of things that don't have style, which we weren't really, Windows 1. Remember Windows 1?
Wow.
Neither do I.
Yes.
This is a 20 years
not
anniversary
really.
Today on November 20th, 1985. Microsoft shipped Windows for the first time. Did anybody even like use this product, Christina? Do you have any historical knowledge on this point? I don't recall it from those days.
No, I've only used it in emulators, and I mean, I don't think anybody used it because it was basically just a true DOS shell. You know, I mean, it was so rudimentary. I think that most of us, or at least my first Windows experience was Windows 3.0 or 3.11.
Yeah.
That was really my first experience with 3.1, and that was 1991. So, it's a great historical context, especially since, you know, what I guess the more famous aspect is that I came out, you know, a few months after, you know, the Mac was released, and obviously, you know, Apple and Microsoft worked together to bring Basic and other apps to the Mac, and then all of a sudden Microsoft comes out with Windows, which had, you know, similar look and feel. And apparently, you know, as history tells us, Steve Jobs was not happy about that. And
Yeah, and as we've seen in all the movies, all the Steve Jobs movies. Now, one of the next version of Windows was Windows 2.0, which hit around 1987. That completely went unnoticed. And then, as you pointed out, Windows 3.0, 3.1, 3.11, those all came out, and that's when Windows took off. And I recall we launched Windows Magazine in, I think it was the end of 1990, early 1991, something like that. And I'll never forget that the editor-in-chief, Fred Lango, wrote an editorial for that issue saying that, Microsoft Windows was now growing enormously and that there were now 4 million users. So that, you know, it's amazing how huge it's gotten since then.
Real talk. Are there 4 million Windows Phone users?
That's a good/bad question because the answer
Right? Like, I'm being like honest right now because 4 million, I mean, obviously that's nothing. Like, Windows probably does. I mean, in certain years, I don't think they do this anymore, but there have been periods of time when they've done that many activations and, you know, in a week. You know, certainly when a big release comes out, they do gangbusters and Windows runs the world. Even though, you know, it's kind of fallen out of popularity to the web and to mobile and to a lesser extent to Mac, but, you know, Windows still runs everything. And it's interesting that really the first, I'd say probably, you know, as we were saying, you know, the first 5-6 years of its existence, it kind of went unnoticed. And obviously, we celebrated the 20th anniversary of Windows 95 a couple months ago, and that was like the, you know, peak Windows, right? That was like everybody was like, "Oh my God, Windows is amazing!" But it's funny to go back and look back 30 years ago and see where it started. And it wasn't very pretty. It wasn't very functional. DOS was still pretty much the better thing, but it was a different time. You know, I mean, Atari and Commodore both made computers in 1985. Yeah. What's really interesting about it, I think, is that Windows managed to become the standard, and that was not in any way a foregone conclusion. I mean, DOS was kind of the preeminent thing, but there was still room in that market for other people to come in and have a shot. But Microsoft, thanks to Bill Gates, you know, acumen and leadership, just they were able to just nail everything, get the software that they needed for it. And even though Windows didn't really work that well at first, it ended up evolving into, you know, the biggest operating system on the planet.
Yeah, it did.
Well, and I guess Android.
Well, yeah, I think it's fair. It's fair to say that Windows is by far the dominant desktop platform. The problem is that desktop is no longer the dominant platform. So Android is by far the biggest operating system in history, simply because mobile is eating the world, and Microsoft kind of missed that one a bit in terms of the big numbers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, very very crazy, and it's hard to even remember at this point what was happening in 1985 on these multiple platforms. But one of the biggest problems with adoption or even interest in Windows 1.0 was the fact that there was a large quantity of alternative shells you could choose.
Yeah,
you could just buy a shell and run it on top of DOS, and most of them worked better, and all of them looked better than Windows did. And so it was, you know, they actually had competition for what to put on top of DOS. So what a weird world that was. So when most of us were just like imagining what's going on with the computer and typing these cryptic commands, and lots of people did it. Very weird. All right, well, let's jump into our top story. LG launched its Urbane second edition LTE smartwatch last week to great fanfare. The signature feature is that the watch doesn't need a phone to make calls or get mobile data. It just does it directly. But after 6 days on the market, LG has stopped selling it. Ron Amadio is the reviews editor for Ars Technica and joins us to talk about it. Hey, Ron, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Great to be here.
Glad you're here. Now, why did LG cancel this watch?
They're not exactly saying. What they've told us and a couple other websites is that it's a hardware issue. That's all they'll really say about it. The quote they gave to Android Police was a hardware issue that affects the day-to-day functionality of the device. And after further investigation, the decision was made to cancel the rollout of the Urbane second edition LTE due to the complicated nature of the issue. So it sounds like something's super broken, and we found out about it after we shipped it, and now we're not sure if we can fix it.
That's insane. And I for this type of product, I think maybe even it's not unprecedented, but it's certainly rare. Did they already ship these out to customers? I mean, do customers already have these? And if so, is there a recall? Are they going to be like, hey, here's your money back, or hey, send them back to us, kind of like Google did with the Nexus Q? What are they doing? Have they actually made their ways to customers yet?
Yeah, it's been on sale for 6 days. It's been in Verizon and AT&T stores, and a couple people have them. What I've heard is that you can take it back to the store for a refund, but there's really no official recall going on right now.
Well, that's great. That's really reassuring. Thanks, LG. I mean, you know, you buy this thing. How are people going to even find out unless they happen to follow some of the news stuff? So you buy this, or you buy it for somebody as a Christmas gift. You're not keeping up because LG makes a lot of smartwatches. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. Now the company is like, actually, we don't want to sell this anymore. Way to go, LG. That's great.
Incredible. Now, Ron, I wanted to ask you about your opinion on this. Does this give you a bad feeling about LG's quality control? I mean, let's take it, first of all, take it at face value that there's some massive hardware issue that would cause them to entirely cancel a product that they didn't notice until after it was shipped. Does that make you feel a little queasy about LG's quality control system?
Yeah, I mean, it's really embarrassing that they didn't catch this at first. But I mean, a lot of companies are like this, like Samsung shipped the Note 5, and you could get the pen stuck in there if you put it in backwards. So it seems to be just kind of like buyer beware on some of this stuff. But I mean, we've found out about all of it. Like, it's not like it's secretively crappy or something. Like, if you read up on this, you know about it, and just pay attention. And I don't know. I feel like I'm shilling to say read more reviews online. But
read more reviews
on products,
online,
I guess.
Do we have any sense of whether or not LG is going to try to get this back on the market, or do you think they're just scrapping this? Because I mean, their statement didn't seem very clear. So do you have a sense of whether or not they're going to actually try to fix this and get this back on the market, or are they just saying bye, YOLO?
PR says all they'll say is that decision has not been made yet. So
wow.
So again, it's just terrible. There's some horrible hardware problem, and if they can fix it, they'll sell it. If they can't fix it, then they won't sell it anymore.
Now, LG hastened to add that there's nothing dangerous going on here. The watch isn't going to kill you. It's not going to irradiate your wrist or anything horrible like that. But the fact that they're not saying what the problem was, really, it's kind of a Streisand effect. I think that we're going to keep hammering away at this till we find out. So I think they should come clean and say, here's exactly what the problem was. Ron, do you think there's a possibility that there's some other explanation? For example, what if they shipped this thing and nobody bought it and they wanted to avoid a black eye and just said, you know what, we're pulling off the market, we're going to make up some excuse. Do you think something like that is likely, or do you take this at face value?
No, this is way worse than it just failing, because now they look incompetent. And I mean, this watch was a big deal. Like, it was on it was on Google's official Android blog the other day. Like, it's the first Android Wear device with LTE. It's the first Android Wear device that ships with Marshmallow. Like, this watch was supposed to be a big deal, and they just shut it down.
Very, very strange. Ron Amadio is at ArsTechnica.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at Ron Amadio. Ron, thanks for joining us today, as always. More news coming up, but first I want to talk about Sheetz. I want to talk about Bowling Branch, one of our sponsors today. You know, this isn't for everybody. This is only for people who sleep. It's only for people who want a good night's sleep and high-quality sheets, which are organic, cotton, fair trade. We're talking about ethics in the products we buy. Fair trade sheets. And they're so affordable. They've really disrupted the industry, because in the industry, you can buy really horrible cheap sheets for a reasonable price, or you can buy really high quality sheets at an outrageous price. Sometimes the markups in department stores are like 800% or something like that. And Bowling Branch came along and disrupted this industry in a big, big way, selling you really high quality sheets at a very low price. And they're so confident in the fact that their sheets are awesome that they'll let you try them risk-free for 30 nights. You can sleep in them for 30 nights, and at the end of 30 nights, you can say, you know what, I'm going to send them back. You're not going to do that. You're going to love these sheets, and you're going to be so glad you bought them and heard about this message from Bowling Branch. Now, it gets even better. If you order right now, they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. Go to bowlingbranch.com and use the offer code TNT, and $50 off immediately by just go to bowlingbranch.com. Make sure you use the offer code TNT. Microsoft and Volvo announced a partnership to build what they're calling next generation automotive technologies, including, of course, a next generation marketing technology, namely a Volvo HoloLens app. CNET senior editor Sean Hollister flew to Redmond to experience it all firsthand. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thanks for having me. How's it going, folks?
It's going great. Thank you very much. And, I just wanted to ask you, first of all, what was this demo like? What did it feel like to experience the inside of a Volvo through HoloLens?
It was pretty much like any other HoloLens experience. You get to see computer-generated objects appear in the real world that aren't actually there. And in this case, it was an automobile that doesn't actually exist yet. The Volvo S90 is a vehicle it's a sedan that's based on a current SUV that Volvo makes, but nobody's actually seen this car in the flesh and been able to talk about it yet. So I got to see this vehicle and, in this 3D computer generated way, as if it was there in front of me on a stage, even though the car wasn't actually there and the car hasn't actually been built by Volvo and shown to people yet.
That's pretty awesome. So this sounds like the demo is pretty far along. When do we think this is actually going to show up in showrooms?
They say they're going to be showing it to consumers with HoloLens in 2016, sometime next year. This will be something that you get to try. But they were very, very – they weren't very sure exactly which of the demos I saw might make it to the final experience. I saw all kinds of things. I saw, you can walk around this tiny little model car and see how the designer was inspired to create it. Another little demo where you can see how the safety features work. It'll follow you around with its little radars and cameras to show you that the car can see around it in 360 degrees and help prevent crashes. It wasn't sure which of these various demos would actually make it to the final experience.
Now, I'm curious about the nature of this demo that you experienced. Now, you said that you and you were in a room with one other person. That other person was wearing HoloLens, and you were both looking at the same thing. Were you able to interact? Was there like a walkie-talkie type of setup, or are you just talking naturally over the air? What was the interaction with the other person?
Yeah.
They were able to control it, and you saw what they control. Like, can you talk about what it's like to use HoloLens with two people?
Oh, yeah. It's actually really simple, really intuitive, and very rudimentary right now. It was a very scripted demo. The presenter obviously knew exactly what she was going to say at every point of the process. So you walk into a room, and you can imagine just like if there was a real car in there, there's a professional representative here to show you all the different features and point out, oh, here's the headlights and they're shaped like Thor's hammer, and here's the tail light design, and here's the way the drivetrain works. The difference, of course, is that we're seeing objects that don't actually exist in the room. So I've got a HoloLens headset on, she's got a HoloLens headset on, and we can see the entire room around us because HoloLens, you get your peripheral vision. You can see the whole room around you. It's a transparent display. You're looking through the CG objects, basically, to see the whole rest of the room. It's not like the virtual reality where there's a thing over your face and you can't see anything. You can see her. I could see her. I could talk to her. She was talking to me. We were looking each other in the eyes. And every so often, both of us instead would look at a car that didn't actually exist, and she'd be pointing to features of it that didn't actually exist, that just appeared out of thin air, that were only visible to the both of us because we were both using this headset that let us see things. And basically, since the computers, they know that they're looking at a table, and they know that above the table there's supposed to be an invisible car that will only appear to people wearing this headset. Both of our headsets know where that car is supposed to be. Both of us can point with our actual fingers at features of that invisible car, that car that's invisible to everybody else in the room, and we'll both know exactly what we're talking about because we can both see it.
It's like a hallucination, in other words. So, a shared one. It's like the 60s. So, you wrote that some of the things Microsoft and Volvo want to do aren't actually practical because HoloLens is technical limitations. It sounds like they're a little delusional or maybe a little bit looking too far into the future. Can you talk about what are the technical limitations or what are the things they want to do that they probably won't be able to do?
Yes, absolutely. Everything I described, I obviously saw and I thought was a pretty decent marketing experience in terms of, yes, this is cool. The car looks cool. I could see myself, I think I would look cool in this car. I don't think I could ever afford one, but that's beside the point. However, they also, when I was talking to some Volvo executives, they talked about future things they'd like to do with this technology. They talked about, hey, let's put you in an actual Volvo S90, the actual car. And then while you're inside the car, we can show you things like, and here you are driving the car. Here's the road ahead. Here are some of the safety features. Here's how the car would react to you if you were in this accident situation, if you were in this potential accident situation, which you would never want to do on a real test drive, of course. And I don't know how practical that is yet because of some of the HoloLens technical limitations. Right now, you can't get very close to a computer-generated object with the HoloLens. If you walk up very close to the car, for instance, you walk up very close to this computer-generated car, around the edges of your vision, you only see the real world. You don't see the computer-generated things. You only see the computer-generated things in a box that's about the size of a large smartphone hanging out about an inch in front of your face. You can't see anything computer-generated above it, below it, to the right, to the left of this box. You don't see the computer-generated stuff, only the real world. So you walk up to the car, what looked like a car at a distance, you only see the door. For instance, you only see a little portion of the dash of the car, and it makes it difficult to know where to look. If you were looking out the windshield of a real car and trying to see virtual things, you'd only see them in the center of your vision, where you're pointed. There's a car off to your, an incoming vehicle or pedestrian off to your peripheral. You're not going to see that in the current implementation of the HoloLens.
All right. Well, Sean Hollister is at CNET.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Starfire2258. Sean, thank you so much for coming on Tech News Today. I want to get you on a lot more often. We haven't had you on the show since like early last year or something like that. I want to get you on a lot more often. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Bye-bye. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. All right. Facebook yesterday made breaking up easier to do. Of course, Mike Murphy joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Our relationship expert, Mike Murphy. So how is Facebook now making breakups easier?
Well, they've basically launched this new tool that is going to let you, after you've done the hard part of actually raking up with someone, hopefully, and not just use this tool, you basically can eradicate any existence of this former lover of yours from your life on Facebook by this new breakup tool. You can see less of a person. You can get rid of basically any past thing you've been tagged in with them. And you can even kind of change your profile so they can't see certain things about you. And basically, yeah, just kind of, you know, completely wipe that existence from your and their mind.
So when you say that I think we should see other people, you're talking about Facebook here.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, literally. But this is interesting. This is for the people who are they break up, and they obviously go through the process of breaking up on Facebook and making it Facebook official that you're no longer together. But they're still too passive aggressive to actually like unfriend one another.
Yeah, I don't.
Am I understanding this correctly?
No, you're totally right. I don't get a situation. I mean, maybe I just have not been in these kind of relationships, but I don't know. Like, when would there be a situation where you're like, I don't want to ever see anything about you, but I still want to be friends.
We should still be friends for appearance's sake. I mean, because honestly, the only reason you want to do that is when you want to stalk them, right? Like, so you want to do the Facebook stalk after the breakup. You're like, oh, what does this new girlfriend look like? What does this new boyfriend look like? Like, what's the situation here? Rather than just doing being an adult, being like, you know what, let's not be friends. But the default option on this, it seems like, is to reduce rather than to stop posts from an ex. Is there any indication about how Facebook chooses what to show and what not to show, or is it just based on volume?
I think it's based on volume. Guessing on what Facebook likes to show more of these days, I'm assuming it's going to be pictures and videos. But yeah, there's no like gradation. Like, I want to see 75% less of this person.
I want to see someone's status update, but I don't really want to see photos because maybe the photo will be of, you know, him with someone else.
Yeah, that would be really smart. They didn't go into any of that kind of detail. But guessing, you know, with all their machine learning and AI technology, they're probably putting that to good use. And oh, that person's been tagged with your old best friend.
Wow. You know, Mike, I worry about the future of algorithmically sorted reality when those algorithms and how they operate and what their criteria are completely secret and kept away from us. And this is an example of, you know, this is something that shows up in your newsfeed that's unpleasant. And it reminds me of a feature that Facebook rolled out recently where they are not showing you unpleasant, or you have the option to opt out of unpleasant anniversary. Like, for example, they don't give you this rosy thing. Oh, 2 years ago, you had leukemia, and you know, you want to reminisce about
that,
this.
Though. I think those are different. I think that it's one thing to be like, I don't want to be reminded of the anniversary of my, you know, like father or whoever, someone passing away, versus let's still be friends with someone, but remove all of your tags with them and show them less on your feed because you're not enough of an adult to actually unfriend them.
Yes, that's absolutely true. But what both those have in common is it's unpleasant personal things in your newsfeed. And the reason I think it's a bit of a concern is if you remember the big experiment that Facebook was caught conducting, where they were basically filtering the newsfeed to show you positive or negative stuff to see if you would then go turn around and post more positive or more negative stuff. And what they learned was, yes, you will. So if you get happy stuff in your newsfeed, you'll post happy stuff and everybody's happy. And then everybody likes Facebook more, and then you buy more stuff.
This was a service that was created by and for millennials originally. And I think you should know, Mike, that as an older millennial, I will tell you that we do not like to live in reality.
This is true.
Facebook is kind of the opposite of that in a lot of ways. But I think you're right to a degree. It becomes like an echo chamber of positivity. And, you know, the news feed is in no way a feed. It's just like an algorithmic, like, weird thing that's completely outside of chronology, which is why Twitter is kind of better in that regard if you're looking for, like, the actual news or something like that. But I don't know. I'm kind of with you, Mike, on this one. Like, I feel like it shouldn't necessarily be up to a computer to decide – whether I'm going to be emotionally stable enough to do this.
Totally. Absolutely.
And I don't think I should, you know, we shouldn't be opting out of hard stuff. You know, just like in the same way that Facebook shouldn't necessarily decide what's a crisis and when they should put on their safety thing who's deciding what that is. It seems to be we're kind of leaving this a little too much up to Mark and a few guys down in Astor Place.
And they're always tweaking it to optimize. We don't know what their criteria is for tweaking and what optimization means. Is more engagement always better? They seem to think so. It certainly benefits
Facebook.
Well,
they want to keep you on Facebook. If you make it too depressing, you won't be on Facebook, which means you won't see their videos, which means you won't see their ads, which means Facebook can't continue to,
unless I'm some kind of emo goth who loves depressing and dark things, and in which case that's my personality.
But in that case, you're probably not on Facebook anyway, because you kind of like reject the, as Mike was saying, the false, echo chamber of positivity, when we all know that that's not actually what's happening in the world.
There's a general trend away from user control and toward having things automated. Google just redid Google Plus, and one of the things that they did was they removed the option to unflag. Well, it's more like Pinterest. It's also more like a graphical Reddit. But one of the things that they did that nobody's talking about, or very few people are talking about, not enough people are talking about. Actually, we have a TNT fan who wrote an email. We're going to talk about that in a little while. But basically, it used to be that their algorithms would flag a comment as spam or trolling or whatever. And you can go in and say, no, that's a great comment, and put it back into circulation. You can't do that anymore. So now I have 10% of the comments on my posts are perfectly good comments from totally constructive people that I want to interact with, and Google won't let me unflag them. And so now what I'm doing is I'm copying the entire thing and I'm pasting it back in and I'm saying, hey, look, you got flagged as spammer. Here's your so it's like very it was meant to be a time saver, but now I'm spending all this time copying and pasting people's posts because they were falsely flagged. Anyway, that's the trend in social networks, is to get away from user control toward everything. Don't worry your pretty little head about it. We'll take care of everything. We'll determine what your relationships are. We'll determine how much of your crazy ex you're going to see. All that stuff. And I'm not worried about what exists now on Facebook. I'm just worried if they're incentivized to make everything unicorns and rainbows for us. If that benefits Facebook, I think they'll go in that direction, and then we'll get this kind of bizarre, everybody's happy kind of situation on Facebook. It's already too much like that, if you ask me. So anyway, Mike Murphy, before we cut you loose, any final thoughts on this whole thing?
I think one thing that is pretty funny is the fact that last week, or was it earlier this week, there was that new service that's like Uber for breakups, where you can pay someone to go break up with you.
So, oh my
God. We're getting to a point now where we can just not deal with anything. I can't wait for every hard decision in my life to be made by an app. It's going to be so easy to be the next generation. I don't have to do anything hard.
Completely. Well, and I have to say, and I'm going to share this with you guys and with the TNT audience, because I've been married for a while now and I'm completely over this. But what's so ironic about this is that I once found out about a breakup before it happened because of Facebook, because he changed the Facebook status before he came over and broke up with me. And I noticed that Facebook no longer had us as in a relationship. And I went, oh, okay, so I can prepare myself for this. So it's really funny that now they're that it went from being a service where you literally could be blindsided when it was still a college-only thing to, now they want to make it really easy on you.
Wow, that's amazing. What I want is a Tinder that's automated that just connects you with a relationship. It doesn't really have to even tell you about it. Interacts with you so you don't have to interact with the person, then breaks up for you. So you're not getting involved in any of it. Just leave me out of the whole thing. Get rid of the drama. Anyway, Mike Murphy, thank you so much for joining us. Mike Murphy's at QZ.com and on Twitter at MCWM. Mike, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bye-bye. Well, iFixit did their famous teardowns on two really interesting products. And what's interesting about these two products together is that one of them, which is called the Fairphone, got a perfect score on upgradability. I guess repairability is what they call it. And the other one, the Apple Pencil, got a failing grade. So we got the whole spectrum in these two products. iFixit CEO Kyle Weens joins us right now to talk about these two teardowns. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thank you for coming on. Now, can you tell us about the Fairphone? What is the Fairphone? And what did you discover? What did your team discover when you guys did this teardown?
Yeah, so the Fairphone is a startup out of Amsterdam, and there are a bunch of folks that said, hey, what if we had a phone where we actually traced all the materials of the phone back to the source and sourced things in an ethical manner? And they released Fairphone 1, which was a ODM reference design. It wasn't a particularly interesting phone from a mechanical perspective, but they sourced everything ethically. That was their first version. And then for Fairphone 2, they said, okay, now we're going to actually design a phone like we think an ethical phone would be designed, which is something that's very straightforward, easy to take apart. Super durable, but then when it inevitably breaks, very straightforward and easy to fix. And it's a really impressive design. I have never seen a product that was really this well thought out from a product life cycle perspective. It says designed to open right on the side, and you can pull it apart. You can get most of the way into it without any tools. Like you can swap the display in about 10 seconds without any tools. And display is wow. You know, cracking the screen is one of the most common things that people break.
So it's obviously it's really easy to tear down and repair. How easy is it to actually source materials if you needed to do a repair? Like, say you do need to replace the display. How common is the sort of glass that they're using? And that, you know, would it be something that someone would easily be able to find someplace so that they could do a swap?
Yeah, so Fairphone is selling parts directly. They're also working with us to sell parts. So this is a Europe-only phone right now. So the distribution of the parts is only in Europe, which is fine. And they're making the parts reasonably affordable. They're not trying to make a ton of money off of the service parts. One interesting thing about phones in general is that it doesn't really matter what phone it is. The parts are going to be specific to that phone. If it's a Moto X, you need a headphone jack for a Moto X. No headphone jack for any other phone is going to work. So Fairphone has to be the one selling the parts, but they're committing to doing that and supporting the phone for a number of years.
Kyle, do you have any opinion about the Fairphone as a phone? Is it fast? Is it enjoyable to use? What do you know about the phone itself?
Yes, so this is a great question. I haven't used it yet. We only took it apart. So I've taken it apart a few times, but I haven't had a chance to actually use the final one. So I couldn't tell you. I'm hearing good things, but I don't know.
Okay, so let's talk about the Apple Pencil, which if this was a school, would have gotten an F. On your teardown. What makes the Apple Pencil so unrepairable?
Yeah, so this is kind of reminiscent of the iPod Shuffle design a little bit. So this is the pencil. And in order to get into it, we had to use a Dremel and cut all the way over.
Wow.
That's amazing.
So we've got this very long cut. And inside it, nestled inside the plastic is this metal sheath. And this is steel. It's pretty darn rigid. I think they were trying to avoid a Bendgate situation with the pencil. So this whole thing is assembled by sliding this cartridge into the inside of this. So they're assembling it kind of like a big long cylinder. It's interesting. I've seen this type of mechanical design in one other place in the world, and that is in oil rig drilling. They use these really sophisticated sensors, and they're in a tube that's about 3 inches in diameter and 3 to 5 feet long. And they run it all the way down into the oil drill. And so they have to design everything to work inside of a cylinder. And so you end up with these really weird circuit board designs. Like this is the main PCB for it. And you can see it folds open. So it's actually like there's 4 sides and 2 boards. And then it folds together to fit inside of this weird cylinder shape. So this is all, and then here's the battery, of course, which is also a cylinder. So everything about this was how can we pack as much electronics into a cylinder that's kind of the right shape? And so as a result of sliding everything in and then using glue in the process, it's just not physically possible to pull this apart without damaging it.
I mean, in fairness, I mean, it would seem to me it's a $100 item. I mean, you could maybe make the argument that you would want to replace the battery, although given the number of cycles it says it can use, the iPad Pro that you would use it with would probably be obsolete first. Do you think that, I mean, obviously it's ridiculous you had to use a Dremel to get into this thing, but this is really kind of one of those items that is kind of designed to be disposable, that if it breaks, you buy a new one?
Yeah, and I think that's reasonable. One point, it didn't get a 0, which is the lowest score, and that's because it does have one modular replaceable part, which is the tip.
Yes. Yeah, because it comes with an extra one.
It comes with an extra tip, and this is the tip. And so that just screws on it. It's kind of funny because this is one of the only times I've seen Apple use a screw that's like publicly accessible. The tip is screws on. I think that's a fair point. I'm not super concerned about repairability of this thing. We rate the repairability of everything we take apart, so we figured we'd give it a repair score. But we're not saying don't go buy an Apple Pencil because of the poor repair score. However, Apple is not making any provisions for recycling these things. And you can't run this thing straight into a shredder because it's a safety hazard. You have to separate the battery from everything else at recycling time. And they don't. There's no recycling instructions that Apple's making available for this thing. In contrast, I have the iPad Pro here. So this is the inside of it, and I've got the display. So the display is glued on, but then once you get the display off, we've been really frustrated with iPad designs over the years because the batteries have been glued into the iPad. And I've actually, this battery is upside down right now. And what you'll see on previous iPad batteries, there's huge amounts of glue that make the iPads basically unrecyclable. Recyclers don't know what to do with these things. On this one, they redesigned it and they have these adhesive strips here that come off very easily. And so this is, we were calling this in our announcement that this is the first iPad that we think is possible to recycle safely. So Apple is understanding what the recycling problem is on the iPad Pro, and then in the Pencil, they're not.
Interesting. Well, I mean, you know, and it's, they've had many iterations on the iPad to figure this out. Hopefully future Apple Pencils will be more repairable, more recyclable, et cetera. And Kyle, I want to thank you for all the work you guys do in bringing to light the whole issue of repairability. And I love the fact that you also talked about the and tore down the Fairphone, because it's very difficult. You know, everybody talks about ethics and the environment around electronics, but nobody does anything about it. When I or most people go and buy a phone, we want the fast thing, we want the thing that's going to run the best apps. We have all these criteria that are more important to us than repairability, than the ethics of how the parts are recycled and so on. So it's great that you and your team are bringing this whole issue to everybody's attention. Kyle Weens is at kyleweens.contently.com, and also you can find him and all the teardowns at ifixit.com. Kyle's at kweens on Twitter. Kyle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Kyle. For having me.
All right, bye-bye. In news you can use, IBM's Watson platform has been leveraged once again for a timely publicity stunt. This time, the Jeopardy-winning AI system is predicting which gifts will sell best this holiday season in an iPhone app called IBM Watson Trend. The app predicts gifts in three categories: toys, consumer electronics, and health and fitness. The app mines data from Twitter, thousands of blogs, and more than 200 e-commerce websites. Let's take a look at their crazy, cheesy video.
Knew they'd want the majestic beauty corn, this year's holiday it toy. And to think your husband bought them the Captain Kaboom Space.
Captain Kaboom sounds pretty good, actually.
Seriously good, sir. How did you know? He asks. IBM Watson Trend.
So the kids are really happy with the gift the IBM Watson bought for them.
First, Watson interprets millions of conversations.
Dad's like, I don't care. Just let me sleep.
Yeah, just let me sleep. You do the shopping.
Context and meaning. That's a little sexist. Language.
Yes, it is.
So when Cassidy Rapinski, Florida.
Oh, hey, but Cassidy has a pink phone. Good job. Matches her room. I like it.
Unicorn, so fantasy-licious. Hashtag unicorn.
Fantasy-licious.
Hashtag must have.
Delicious.
Understood.
Yeah.
When thousands of other Cassidys made hashtag unicorn selfies go viral.
Yes. Yeah, it comes with a camera for your children's bedroom.
Next,
yeah. IBM so, you know, Christina Warren, I don't mean to throw too much ice water on this, but, you know, is it really, how much artificial intelligence is required when you're mining data? I guess it's understanding the data, maybe. Like, where's the artificial intelligence of just, like, getting all this data from what's happening on these other sites and saying, oh, here's what's happening on all these other sites?
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe it's a separating some of the conversation from just some of the spam stuff. I don't know. I think it'd be interesting if they – I would be interested to know what sort of sites they're using. Like, if Pinterest were part of it, if you use, like, number of pins and things like that, I could actually see that maybe being interesting. Then you could maybe get into demographical information. This is what's popular with people this age. This is what's popular with people who live in this area. But, again, I don't really know what AI really has to do with that and how that's anything more than just typical big data stuff.
Yeah, I know. I also don't think this is a particularly good gift guide because, you know, human beings are really good at that. Like if you did a gift guide, Christina, I'd say, oh, I trust Christina. I'm going to see what she thinks I should buy people as gifts.
This is just like, this is what's popular. And like oftentimes what's popular, not necessarily exactly what you want to get. Plus, you know, you have to wonder what, you know, you're looking what's popular, what people are searching for, okay, what people are buying. But if you're trying to have a gift guide, you also want things that are going to be in stock. Yeah. So, I mean, this could even backfire. It's like, oh, everybody wants, you know, the Sphero BB-8 toy. That thing has been backordered for, like, months, right? Like, nobody's going to get that for Christmas. So, like, Can you, I mean, so I kind of even wonder about the legitimacy or not the legitimacy. I worry about the action ability of the advice. You know, it's like, oh, this is really popular. This is what you should buy someone. But guess what? Because it's really popular, you can't buy it.
Right. It's better as a what not to buy guide.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you won't have trouble. You don't have to fight for the, you know, with the other parent over the last one on the shelf or whatever, in what was that Arnold Schwarzenegger movie?
With Sinbad. Yeah, no, it was something about holidays. Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Jingle all the way.
Okay, yeah, so that won't happen to you. Thanks to IBM. Yeah. All right, so we've got some more tech news coming right up. But first, I want to talk about our other sponsor, Ring Video Doorbell. I love this thing, and I talk about how it's not just a security device, but I want to talk about security and the many ways that the Ring Video Doorbell secures your home. The first one is, let's give a scenario. Let's say bad guys are casing your house, and they want to rip you off. And so they see that you have a Ring Video Doorbell. And let's say they know what it is, and kind of. And so they decide they're going to destroy it. So they come running up to it, and they destroy it immediately. Okay, two things are going to happen. The first thing that's going to happen is their face in high resolution is automatically uploading into the cloud. So you've already got something to show the police. You'll show the police this nice video. Hey, look at it. They're, you know, really easy to identify the perp. The second thing is that Ring will replace the device. If anybody steals this off your house, they'll send you a new one. And, of course, that person's going to jail because you'll have this great evidence. You'll have the evidence of the entire crime. The second way that they secure your house is if people do know what it is, if they really know how it works, they're not going to get anywhere near your house because there's just no way, because it uploads the video into the cloud, there's no way for them to not be on video. And the third thing is that if they, you know, as Leo says when he talks about the Ring Video Doorbell, which he does all the time, if somebody comes up and rings the bell, that's what people are going to do if they want to rob your house. Nobody just breaks into a house. First thing you do is you find out if anybody's home. You do that by you make up some excuse, and you walk up and you ring the doorbell. And I don't mean you personally. I mean, this is what criminals do, not you, criminals. They walk up to the door, they ring the doorbell, and if you happen to answer, they'll make up some excuse. Oh, we're selling whatever. And if nobody answers the door, they're like, aha, nobody's here, so we can go ahead and break into this house. With a Ring Video Doorbell, what happens is you ring the bell, your phone rings, you answer the door. Doesn't matter if you're in the house, on the other side of the door, or in China. It doesn't matter. As long as you've got a connection to the internet, you can interact, you can see them on video, and you can talk to them back and forth. And you say, hey, what's going on? What is it? You know, and they'll give you their phony excuse and walk away. They'll think you're in the house. And if they don't think you're in the house, if they know you have a Ring Video Doorbell, they know you have a recording of them that's in the cloud, and they have no access to that. And so it's just a great security device. Here's the other way that they secure your house. This isn't a narrow window, like the Microsoft HoloLens, that just shows you one little bit. This the wide-angle lens will cover one side of your house all the way to the other side of the house. In my case, I happen to have my house is situated. It's not in a little alcove or anything like that where the front door is. It's just out in the open. I could, if somebody were to go around to the back of the house, it would capture all of that on video. If somebody went way to the left or way to the right, I'd see it all on video. And so this is a great way to inexpensively secure your house and also have a lot of fun because it's a fun product. All right. I'm not going to go on and on as I normally do with it. Well, I've already done it. It's a great product. I've been using it very happily for a long time now. This year, give the gift of peace of mind and convenience with the Video Doorbell. Time Magazine called it one of their top 10 gadgets. Just go to ring.com/TNT for free expedited FedEx shipping. That's ring.com/TNT. And with Ring, you're always home. And if you get one as a gift, I'll make sure you tell the gift recipient that Mike Elgin said, install it immediately and buy a second one, too, if you got another door. Unfortunately, I don't have enough doors in my house. I'd buy more. All right. Well, we got some feedback from some TNT fans, including email from Michael Morrison, who wanted to talk about Facebook's real names policy. And he wrote, I always hear this being discussed on the program about how they have this policy, but in my experience, this is not the case. I have many friends on Facebook who do not use their real name, and some of them use names that don't even sound like a regular name. So this must not be enforced if they do have such a policy. Additionally, Many of them did have their real name initially upon creating their account, were able to change it after opening their account. I really don't mind whatever they want to call themselves, but I do see it as an issue for someone trying to find them on the site. Just wanted to pass on my experience, love the show, and listen every day. Yeah, I mean, this is what I've always said about Facebook's real names policy. It's not a real names policy. It's a normal names policy. But, of course, what you're saying is it's not even that. It's just a bad policy.
A friend of mine, he had to recently change it because of a job thing, but for years his Facebook name was Bacon Von Meatwatch.
Well, I think I can top that. There's a story in the news right now, the UK's standard newspaper. Some poor dude, he's a Vietnamese Australian. Facebook will not accept his name as being a real name. I'm going to spell it. I can't say it. There's no way to say any of these names, but his first name is Puc. His middle name is D-A-T, and his last name is B-I-C-H. And Facebook simply can't accept this as a real name. And you know what? I have, for the first time, a lot of sympathy for Facebook. I don't think I would accept this either. Sorry. What your name is. All right. Well, we got a message in our Google Plus community from Brian Sullivan, who's talking about the new Google Plus design and its inability to delete or unflag spam comments and Google's automated flagging of comments as troll comments. We talked about this earlier, and he wrote, "These people are not trolling." He's referring to the people who are flagged as trolls by the automated system on the new Google Plus. "As an owner and moderator, you should be able to see the ridiculous amount of functionality they have removed from this app." He's talking about the new Google Plus app. "Have you tried to remove a post, delete a comment, or tag somebody in a comment thread? It's damn near impossible now. Luckily, I'm jailbroken, and I found a way to downgrade. I really hope Google fixes this stuff soon." And I am more sympathetic. I could not be. I'm pretty frustrated by this feature. It's basically yet another example of a social site that is favoring the newbies, the less engaging people. Twitter's been doing a lot of this lately as well, but this is a case in which people don't want to have anything to do with comment moderation or happy as can be because it's all automatic now. Those of us who like to moderate comments are just sidelined, and I really am going to be calling for Google to change this policy. At least go ahead and make this the default, but let us go in there and change this if we want to. Christina, what do you think about this this change of Google Plus?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm going to be honest with you. I kind of think that it should be expected. I mean, they're still trying to kind of figure out what they want from Google Plus. It's been pivoting into a different sort of platform, a different sort of community. I described it as Pinterest. You described it as a visual Reddit. And I do feel like that's different than what it originally started as. And I think that it is problematic, though, if they really do feel like building interest-based communities to not let people moderate correctly. I mean, I think you're right. I think let the default be you don't have to worry about it. But if you're actually wanting to maintain these communities, yeah, you want to be able to control what can and can't go in this stuff, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I wrote a column about this, which I submitted this morning, which will appear on Computer World site on Monday. And I've been studying this whole redesign all week, and I've come to the following conclusion. And it was actually surprising to me to have realized what I realized. And what I realized was that Google Plus launched 4.5 years ago or something like that, 2011. And their vision was to be vastly more. It was to be the everything site. It was supposed to have everything that Google has, video, and it's supposed to have news discovery, and it was supposed to have every type of communication under the sun and photo features and all this kind of stuff. And what I realized, Christina Warren, is that this strategy has succeeded for Facebook. Facebook has glommed on to the original Google Plus strategy. They added the unlimited size for posts. They added the circle and follow friend follow model that Google Plus had initially that Facebook didn't. They added video, which is mostly YouTube video. They're turning it into a news destination. They're doing all the things that Google initially in 2011 wanted to do, but which didn't work for Google. But it is working for Facebook. And I think the reason is that Facebook was a single thing that they turned into many things, and Google was many things, and they tried to force it all into a single thing. And that part of it doesn't work. You can't really do that. The other thing I wanted to point out is that they're emphasizing communities and what's the other one called? I'm blanking on it. They're called collections. Thank you, Jason. And communities are like Reddit, and collections are like Pinterest. And so they're both like Reddit and Pinterest. Just as visual as Pinterest, way more visual than Reddit. Reddit, I think, is more in tune with the zeitgeist of what's happening on the internet. It's a better place for discovering content, Whereas I think Google Plus is a better place in general for having conversations about content. But still, like all social networks, you either like it or you don't. And it's this has become a new type of thing. They've gone from being the everything social network, which didn't work for them, to the we're just this narrow little thing or this couple of things, and that's all we are. And you can find the photos over there, which is now social network agnostic, and you'll find the Hangouts over or in another place, which is its own thing. And by the way, not succeeding that well either. So anyway, it's just it's really interesting that they finally kind of found themselves. They're going to target this little tiny niche.
No, I think it's great. The problem is, of course, by doing this tiny niche, they are risking alienating the people who have stayed in this tiny that have stayed on the service. And I think that's the thing they're going to have to try to balance, right?
You got that exactly.
It's not alienating.
You got that exactly right. So I did a little informal poll on Google Plus about whether people love or hate the new Google Plus, and half of them love it, and half of them hate it. So that's dangerous when you have half of your...
It really is when you're doing this sort of rebrand. I mean, and honestly, I think that it's going to be a struggle. I think that I applaud them for realizing that it's not going to be everything to everyone and for going small and going niche. I do think that they're in a really precarious situation right now with trying to figure out how to balance what, you know, individuals who have been with it a long time want versus trying to gain new people. I think that they would probably do better if they didn't try to gain a ton of new users and instead focused on maybe helping the existing users build out the community more. I don't know. That's my take, but I understand that they might have a different perspective on that.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Google Plus is actually technically growing very, very fast. I monitor my own growth of Circle count, and I believe I'm still on the recommended users list. And Christina, this is a kind of a mind-blowing figure, but my personal follower count, let me see if I can find it here. Okay, here it is. I've averaged over the last year how fast my followers have grown on Google Plus, and I average an additional 3,242 followers a day.
Wow.
A day. And the engagement doesn't reflect that. Like, I don't have, like, crazy, like, massive engagement. So there are a lot of people, like, who may be speaking English as a second language or not speaking English, who don't really see it as a site for enthusiasms and passions, as Google likes to describe it. A lot of people just show up in the comments and say, hi. And it's like dating service or something like that. And it's like, it's kind of surreal. But still, those numbers are there. I'm going to hit 5 million in, like, 3 weeks or something like that.
And
there's a disconnect there between the amount of engagement on my posts and the number of followers I theoretically have. So,
yeah, no, I found that too. When I was active on Google Plus, I used to find that myself too, is because I've hovered around the 900 and something thousand follower mark for most of its time. Again, like you, I was on the suggested user list. And even when I was really active on Google Plus, I never saw the engagement that I would get on a post the same way I would, you know, on Twitter, where I have like less than 75,000 followers, or on Facebook, where I have like 350,000. You know, it's I get far more engagement on those places. I actually, for me, I get the most engagement on Twitter, ironically, but it is interesting how that works out, because I do think that what that shows is that there are a lot of people, for you to get the number of new Circle ads that you get every day, for you to have that sort of rate that's been going, the fact that you're going to hit 5 million means that people are actively still signing up, and they might be using it as a place just to ingest content, maybe not participate, maybe do something else, but it's notable that there is that sort of disconnect between the amount of people that are following you ostensibly and then the amount of engagement you get.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I still enjoy it. I made a lot of friends there and a lot of engagement with TNT fans. So I personally enjoy it, but that's my personal preference. All right. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Hologram Software CTO Dennis Opel, who recently watched Tech News Today on Epson Moverio's smart glasses. Let's check out this photo. There we are. There's the show.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
No, that's a great shot. That's an amazing shot.
Yeah. Imagine you could watch the show and while you're pretending to talk to somebody.
Right? Totally.
Just nod and go, every once in a while. Uh-huh. Perfect. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup or your smart glasses and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Christina Warren, where can people find you and what will they find when they do find you?
Okay, so you can find me on Twitter at @film_girl, Instagram at @film_girl, at Mashable/people/Christina. Actually, if you tune into Mashable Snapchat Discover, there's a new video from me today that I'm starting a new series where I rant about things for brief periods of time. Today it was Nintendo conspiracy theories.
How many podcasts do you do a week?
5.
Wow. That's, well, so do I.
Yeah, I was going to say. Monday through Friday. So yes. same boat here, right?
Yeah.
Well, five counting this one. Yeah, five counting this one.
That's awesome. And I enjoy Rocket. I listen to that every week. That's a lot of fun.
So. Yeah. Rocket's a lot of fun. And we do MASH Talk. Actually, yesterday's MASH Talk was a good one. Lance, Pete, and I all debated because we all have different opinions about kind of the state of mass surveillance and encryption and what roles tech companies should be required to take when it comes to allowing access to devices to law enforcement agencies, on the basis of the New York district attorney's report saying, oh, please tell us what, pre-iOS 8, the encryption level meant that we could get into phones, and that was great. Let us have that again. And I, of the civil liberties side, I'm like, no, that's actually not cool. Pete was on the give access because it can stop things, and Lance was somewhere in the middle. But it was actually a really good, and I think a cogent discussion where that we remain civil, and it was a little tough. We remain civil.
Well done.
But what we all kind of discussed kind of the broader implications of that stuff, because I think it's an interesting thing, especially in light of everything that happened over the last week.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm looking forward to listening to that as well. So Christina Warren, film_girl on the Twitter. And yes. Thank you so much for calling today. Christina, we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Mike.
All right.
See you next week.
Bye-bye. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on your favorite podcast app, of course. You can choose some other way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike Elgin. And don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weekday. And that is the Tech News Today. This show is produced by Jason Kleanthis and edited by Kevin King. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.